Dave Jensen.
Steel Wagstaff.
Happy summer.
I feel like I just saw you. I did see you. We physically embraced very recently.
Yeah, under the flowing waters of the Gushing Goddess.
Oh, but there was some excellent steel art at that. Is it the metal that was used at that place?
It 100% wasn't steel, Dave. You know that because it rusted. Steel does not rust. Come on.
Oh, yeah.
Get your alloys straight. I don't know if this is public knowledge, but for the listeners at home, Dave, you're expecting a new member of the brood.
I believe so, yes. There is a baby inside my wife's uterus as we speak.
Okay. And I have really great news for you, Dave, because we have a guest who can't wait to talk about your wife's uterus tonight. Sig, welcome to Off the Chain.
Sure, that poor uterus is off the chain. Poor thing.
Boy, if you knew the half of it, Sig.
Wait, I know through anecdotes, and that's enough for me. I have a uterus. I can empathize. You dudes.
We don't know the half of it, Dave.
No, I don't. Yeah, other than occasional constipation, that's as much as I can understand. Wait, so Sig, Steele says you're from a giant family. Is this true?
I'm from a giant family. I'm the seventh of eight children. I have five older sisters, one older brother, and one younger brother. And we are either Catholic or Mormon. You take a guess.
Catholic?
Yeah, of course.
Nice.
You can sense the self-hatred in my voice.
Yeah, I could feel there was guilt weighing on you. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's really true. So, yes, I mean, I get big families from the perspective of a woman who was born in 1974, which is the brief years in our political climate.
The Ford years.
People don't even understand your old Ford. In fact, every time I go out on a date, I'm going to leave the rest blank. But my litmus test is like, who is Gerald Ford, sir? and if it's not, then nothing's happening.
It doesn't feel like that's going to advance the date in any way.
It's not.
And let's talk about Gerald Ford.
Gerald Ford.
You know what most commonly happens, Dave, is she's like, tell me about the Ford years, and they just start talking about Model T production, and they're thinking Henry Ford, and then Sig's like, no.
And then we need to talk about Marx, and this is like a whole nerd fest.
Yeah.
But Sig, my question, because I am, of course, Mormon, so that's why my family is gigantic, I guess. I don't really know. But we're about to add the sixth kid.
Oh, good God.
We can no longer fit inside a minivan. It's out. How was your family transported? How did this happen? What was the logistics?
You're deeply underestimating the quote unquote way back. Do the police not allow the way back anymore? So, my family had,
sitting in the way back of the van.
Sitting in the way back. So my family had a green Mercury station wagon. You and your minivan can go suck it. You wusses. We had a green Mercury station wagon so there was like a bucket seat in the front with
classic.
The middle.
Yeah.
And a bucket seat in the back that could effectively fit four children with one person, maybe a baby, maybe me, on someone's lap. And then there was the way back. This was pre-seatbelt days. So just like, I think you could lobby the police to no longer use. Aren't there car seats for like 12-year-olds now?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. I mean, like, we were like the punk. I was like the baby punk in the way back. So, like, this doesn't apply anymore.
So
I can't give you any of that.
No.
Here's the question. When was the longest family road trip you did with all eight children?
Oh, well, time is elusive when you're young. I mean, when you're young.
Distance-wise, the most distant road trip.
Not that long. I mean, we were poor, so we didn't travel long distances in a beat up Mercury station wagon. So I think the longest trip we ever had was probably like to Minocqua, like in Wisconsin. So like 4.5 hours north.
Classic.
Riding in the way back, looking at nothing but the moving sky and the storms as a baby.
I'm still trying to put together how you guys were poor with eight kids. I mean, the money must have been pouring in to keep having them. Otherwise, come on.
Well, no, I mean, money in terms of largesse came from the Catholic Church and giving us our screwed up education, but.
Excellent.
Yeah, I think it was like a discount after you had four children. You suddenly got tuition free at the parochial school, but that's it.
Get three free. That's the Catholic discount.
We have a generational chasm. I can tell you about other things, but maybe not transportation. We can talk about resentment and old parents, which you're about to be.
So Dave's got triplets, twins, and now a singleton's coming. But Dave, here's a piece of advice. So I don't have this direct experience, but my mom is the eighth of nine, and then her mother died, and the grandpa remarried, and then there was another kid added, so she was ninth of ten. And what my grandpa did was he literally bought an old school bus, repainted it. They called it the Hippopotabus. And they drove it all over the country. They took the Hippopotabus from Utah to Washington, D.C. one summer. I think they put like a bathroom or a shower of some kind in the Hippopotabus. I don't understand the engineering, but they did drive it. It was like a little mobile home, a school bus they turned into a house. That would look great in Prescott Valley. What, the nurse driving his Hippopotabus.
The solution is going to be just a giant white shuttle van that someone has been using to shuttle people to the airport from Prescott. That's the only option. And what I would really like to do is paint a huge mural of Jesus on the side and just embrace it. Cause I got six kids. I do like Jesus. So why not have him on my vehicle?
Classic. Are you thinking like stylized in any way or just a straight photorealistic portrait?
I think just like a black, it's just, kind of the black outline of Jesus. Maybe
I say black Jesus. Maybe. That would have been pretty progressive.
Yes.
Are you not worried that your love of Jesus and having a large family, because what I just told my mother this weekend was that her having eight children in Catholicism was the perfect gateway into all of her children becoming atheists.
we'll cross that bridge when we get there. But the issue is there was no giant painting of Jesus on your station wagon, and that's where everything fell apart for your family. So.
You're right.
Dave, if you're open for suggestions, you know those guys that do the quick sketches? Like, they're sitting there and they'll do like a quick 10-minute sketch of you. And it's usually like a small body but caricature head.
Oh, yeah.
You should do one of those of Jesus. That'd be good.
It'd be tasteful. So, yeah.
Hey, well, this is perfect. We're talking about big vehicles. We're talking about art. And that sets us up perfectly for our next segment. And the segment that I really want to talk about, both of you, it's very rare that we have more than one artiste on the podcast. And Dave, I don't know if you know this, but you and Sig both share a love of cartooning and illustration, drawing.
Boy.
The little bit of background, Dave's pretty well known in the children's book community for his Pickle Soda Press.
I love it.
And the Gentle Bear series. The Gentle Bear series. It's really...
I love all of that. That's so wonderful.
It's quite popular.
I love the idea of a Gentle Bear and a Pickle Soda. So these are lovely things.
Hairy gay men in their 40s love Dave's art. The Gentle Bear is really popular with them.
Yeah.
Unintended audience. But...
Yes, indeed.
Take the fame where you can get it, right, Dave?
He's a wonderful bear. I still draw him from time to time.
Oh, I like the idea of a Gentle Bear.
Yeah, he teaches really heavy-handed moral lessons. So it's pretty good.
I mean, it didn't be namby-pamby. That's for sure. He's a happy bear.
But Sig, what kind of art do you do? What do you like to do?
This is all actually fairly new for me.
Where'd you get your start?
I stopped drawing probably when I was 11 or 12 years old. I remember liking it, but when you're young and sort of before you hit puberty and you're really insecure, you feel fairly fearless. And so I loved art and I loved drawing and I didn't think much about whether or not I was good at it. Mm. And then I sort of, hit puberty and everything felt like there was a fake magnifying glass on you. And so I stopped drawing because I didn't think I was good at art. And then I didn't draw again until now I'm, 42 years old until literally a year ago when I took this comics class from Linda Berry at Madison. Mm. where she teaches at the University of Wisconsin, and she now has an endowed professorship. And I wanted to just do something fun, and so I took the class, and she's really great in that. I mean, a part of what she does is probably, whether she would admit it or not, like art therapy.
Yeah,
where she is trying to really help a lot of folks that she invites into her class who feel sort of broken from grad school or beaten down by life in certain ways, and just helping them do this thing. I'm going to force you to do it through this form of like drawing calisthenics, and I'm not going to allow you literally more than 30 seconds to think. So she would drill us through these exercises. She would be like, you have 60 seconds to draw a monster, or you have 30 seconds to draw a memory. And she would just force us for 2 hours to draw and draw and draw and draw. And so I ended up really enjoying that. And then that helped me sort of realize I really liked to do this, and it felt like a form of an escape. And so, yeah, that's how I got into it. It was not that long ago. But since then, I've been drawing a lot and I have a lot of fun with it, because I'm sort of a writerly sort, and the drawing part is something that sort of surprised me that I enjoyed. And yeah. Yeah, that's, I'm babbling a little bit, but that's my story. I mean, the thing is, I'm not an artist by any means. I would never call myself that. I draw sometimes.
Yeah, you're an artiste.
That's what I said.
How you pronounce
artiste.
It.
What about you?
Oh, I, Sig, this may surprise you, but once you get up to 5 kids, like, your art time is greatly decreased. So most recently, what I've been doing is drawing various female superheroes for my girls to color and then cut out.
Oh, of course.
And so that's been pretty fun. But no, I love drawing. I've loved it ever since I was a kid. I think that I kind of have a little bit of ADD. I can't sit still while in class, so I would have to just fill up notebooks with drawings while I'd have to sit there. So I still love drawing.
Part of the problem, Sig, was that Dave was a communications major, so there was no substance in any of his undergrad classes, so he had to do something.
Oh, that's not true, although kind of.
But no, it's true. It's very true.
We can't compete. If you want to compete against do undergrad to undergrad major, I was a business major, and that... there's a reason I've now been in graduate school in the social sciences and the humanities for 9 years. I was trying to make up for lost time, for lost intellect.
Penance and rehabilitation. Very Catholic. You just can't escape.
Yeah.
So, Dave, the other question that we had for you, though, for both of you, I guess, would be influences or illustrators that you love. I know, Sig, you've had a lot of friends that have actually been cartoonists or professional artists.
Yeah, I mean, they're in a very specific subset. I mean, I have some friends who are specific cartoonists, and they have there's a very distinct style that the New Yorker invites, and a very distinct, and I would argue somewhat narrow sense of wit that goes along with that. But very narrow.
So friends that draw dogs are great being psychoanalyzed, is that the kind of
mix we're talking about? And a certain pen and ink quality to it, and it's great, but it's very circumscribed to the New Yorker's very sort of cheeky upper crust white humor, for sure. Okay.
All right, so other influences, illustrators that either of you love?
Ever since I was young, I loved Calvin and Hobbes. So Bill Watterson, like I still every once in a while will spend like an entire every break period at work reading about like where's Bill Watterson now, because like nobody really knows what he's doing. But just the his style, his illustration with Calvin and Hobbes was fantastic. Now most of my illustrations exposure is through children's books. I love Erin Steed. She's illustrated I don't even know what the style is, but she's done a number of her husband's books. She illustrates them, and she's done some of her own. But the ones I like best are the ones that her and her husband have collaborated on. They did Lenny and Lucy, a really cute book about a boy building people to defend his house, basically. And they did the Caldecott winning one about a zookeeper. That's awesome. A Sick Day for Amos McGee. And her illustrations are fantastic.
I actually know Erin Steed from one of my favorite recent children's books, which is it's called If You Want to See a Whale. The author, Julia Fogliano is the writer who she has collaborated with at least twice. Her illustrations are lovely. And this book, If You Want to See a Whale, is so deeply poetic, and her visuals with Julia Fogliano's words are awesome. I love it.
Other favorite Sig?
And for me, my favorite, they're the older illustrators, or at least classic illustrators. Jules Pfeiffer, I remember moving to New York City, and I wasn't well read or well anything before I moved there. And I remember seeing a magazine with a Jules Pfeiffer illustration on the cover, and Jules Pfeiffer, the way he uses pen and ink and draws these beautifully sort of like lanky, expansive. The visuals are so lovely.
That's the one everybody knows.
Of course. Yeah. The Phantom Toll Booth, and the way his visual aesthetic to me is something that I just resonates with me in so many ways. And that was probably the first time I realized, oh, I love illustration. Uh-huh. And I started to look at more. And then one of my most recent favorites is a French illustrator named John Julius, and I love him because he has these very sort of almost like it's probably black charcoal oil, but like these dark graphic lines with sort of colored. It's cartoonish in a lot of ways, but he's an illustrator, and he's just lovely. Like he creates these shapes through the sort of the use of the dark line, and then amazing. And he does a lot of things. Like he's a cartoonist, he's an illustrator, and then a lot of like weird fashion labels and weird, very chichi Parisian brands have been hiring him lately to do big, weird installments.
Cool. Yeah, Julien. I'm looking that up right now.
Jean Julien. Sorry.
Okay. I don't feel like I have as deep knowledge of illustrators, but I do have mostly childhood anchor points or books that really struck me in my visual imagination. And the ones that I remember most clearly, there are these Dolaire Book of Myths. There was Norse myths and a book of, I think, Greek myths. And there are these bright, almost like crayon color drawings of Norse and Greek mythology. When we went to Sacramento just recently, we took Cedar and we were walking around the children's library looking at books. And I saw the Dolaire Book of Greek Myths. It's D'Aulaire. And I think it was a husband and wife team, maybe. And the book just brought back so many memories. I just stopped whatever I was reading to Cedar and just started looking through this book. And it just transported me to a certain time in my childhood. And I realized that's really the power of vivid illustrations for so many of us as we're beginning to become literate. These visual images anchor in our minds. It's such a cool power, I guess, that artists have.
Yeah, and there's a weird thing about that we go through formal schooling and that sort of drops away, but image and text, you know, work together for a long, long time. And I mean, I came around to image and text then later in life, but you know, that the photo book or the children's book or, and everything we see online is so visual that it's such a natural thing to bring those two things together. And for whatever reason, those things become siloed as you go through, you know, grammar and secondary school, and that seems like a real loss in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I like kind of, because I was thinking, like, you know, what is it about illustration that's so compelling? And you guys both made just excellent cases for it. Just the visual is, there's so much imagination power in just seeing the visual. And yeah, you can immediately be transported back to your childhood and to just a very imaginative state by seeing these kind of pictures. And that must be why I love it so much.
Yeah. I think about watching my son, Cedar, reading now, and he's learning letter shapes and how words sound, but really it's image that when he talks about reading, he's staring at images. And before he's literate, he's like, there's a state of absorption, like total concentration, where I see his whole tension, his whole body just absorbed in the book or the image. Now, the other thing that happened recently was Laurel just got a bunch of childhood artifacts from her mom who's moving house. And among them were a bunch of children's books. And my wife, Laurel, was really describing this synesthetic experience that she has with these child books. It's not just visual memory, but it triggers taste experience, smells, sounds. She has this total sensory experience. And I think that's probably also a partial result of what that total state of concentration and absorption. Your whole body enters the image in some way. That's just an amazing phenomenon.
And it's interesting looking at some of these. I love children's books. We've talked about them a lot. Just to the right of me, there's like 300 of them on the shelf here. I love it. For Father's Day, that's what I got, was 5 children's books, and I couldn't have been more pleased. But yeah, and now, but just seeing these pictures and also seeing them from the perspective of someone that really enjoys drawing and making art, I love to just think about the great energy and creativity that went into making these pictures. And like, I guess I don't feel jealous of the artists, but I'm just like all the more excited about what they've done.
So we've sort of primed the pump. Everybody in this listening is like, yeah, art is great. Making art, I want to draw. I want some rapid fire questions for the two of you artists, and we'll just grab quick answers that will kind of prime the pump a little bit. So Dave, you mentioned you're drawing female action heroes or superheroes right now.
Yes.
What are you drawing, Sig, right now? What's the project or what have you been drawing lately?
So I've been trying to work on, so I guess it would be called a series, but more of a thematic motif. So I've been really interested in living in Madison, Wisconsin, the insufferable hippie capital of the world, or at least of the upper Midwest. I'm so enthralled by the performance of the Madison hippie against, like, the angry stoic me who just can't handle any of that for more than 5 seconds. And so every time I go into the Willie Street Co-op, which if you don't live in Madison is like it's a food cooperative, and it's like a Portlandia sort of trite, insufferable place with beautiful vegetables. But I've been trying to think that, like, I go in there and I often just feel completely put out by everyone there. Like, and so I'm trying to sort of graphically represent these different instances of my angst in the Willie Street Cup, which I have called vegan plus sausage. I am the sausage.
That's so perfect. That's really perfect for the Willie Street Co-op. They should make that their new motto.
Yeah, and one of the things I'm struggling to draw it because, like, and Steele, I think you've heard this before, but like one very typical scene when you have to watch hippie or privileged white precious organic eating couples chomp. One person should be left at home via a rule, because like I'll be standing in front of the broccoli rabe and the root vegetables, and the couple sits there and performs, and they're just like, honey, like, what should we have for dinner? And he's like, I don't know. I mean, should we have squash? Should we have roasted squash? I don't know. Should we have kale? Should we have roasted kale? And then they basically start like, it's like this big anxiety fest, and then they practically start weeping. And I just want to reach around and get some fucking broccoli, because for me, I just need to get home and cook. And so I'm trying to represent that graphically through a series called Vegan Plus Sausage. But visually, it's very hard to represent because I'm trying to like draw these. How do you draw the insufferable, privileged white hipster / hippie couple from Madison? And then how do you relay that, and how do you relay my anger?
Angry grocery store. It sounds like perfect children's book with recipe.
They take up so much space, and I think their children must be like, you guys are hopeless.
Yeah,
like I am a toddler and I simply need calories and fat so my brain can develop to tell you to go to hell and stop being so self-indulgent. They're just sitting there in their McLaren stroller.
that kind of garbage stops once you're at 5 kids. It's not, what are we going to eat tonight? It's like, I'm cooking something.
Yeah.
It's happening right now. Everyone just stop. It's happening. It's okay.
All right, I got 3 more drawing quick hit questions for each of you. Okay. These are real quick hits this time.
Yeah, you're going to edit this.
What medium do you like working in? What do you like to draw materials, draw on, draw with?
I love watercolor. I think that's really fun. And I use a lot of ink with I don't even know what kind of pen it's called, but like a calligraphy pen. And it's fun.
I use the brush and India ink and like various thickness of brushes. I like the variety of that. And I like the starkness of the ink.
Okay. Favorite creation that you've made? What are you most proud of?
I made what I call graduate school trading cards. It was sort of like the garbage pail. This is probably dates me, and you guys don't even understand this. But
I know garbage pail kids.
Yeah, we know the garbage pail kids. And so, like, it's basically a profile of a quintessential graduate student, and then on the back, it's him sort of pontificating. And so, one of them is a guy named I think his name is Gavin Stutely the Third, and he lives in Greenwich, Connecticut, and he's in seminar talking about how much he knows about Deleuze, and and he was of course the editor of his precious white college humor magazine.
I'll trade you two Kevin Hart socks for the Gavin Struck with the Third. Dave, favorite creation?
I do a lot of kind of the pen and ink and then watercolor stuff for my kids. And one that I see every day because it's just above the changing table is for my twins. I did it before they were born, but I still really like it. It's two owls that are twins, and one's dressed like a girl and one's dressed like a boy. And it's
just adorable. Baby owls.
Yeah.
Dave.
No. Yeah.
So sentimental.
Yeah.
Okay, last question. What body part do you find most difficult to draw?
Hands, and I don't know what to do with these superhero ladies' breasts. When I'm drawing them for my girls, I don't know what to do.
Don't.
They're clothed, right? I mean, they're not like, you're not trying to be like, how do I shape the areola and where's the nipple go? Like, put a shirt on them and call it a day.
If you wanted it to be a teaching moment, you could talk about the
this is nursing supermom. This is
real breasts. Yeah, but you don't want to. You don't need to take them there.
No, I
agree. Though
I try to err on the side of away from the cartoonish breasts that are so popular among the comic book superheroes.
Yeah,
it's upsetting. Yeah. The first time I went into a comic book store in New York City, I asked my boyfriend at the time if we were actually in a porn shop.
Yeah.
It was a lot of lonely looking men looking through magazines filled with bosoms.
Gravity defying.
In pen and ink.
All right, Sig, hardest body part for you to draw?
For me, hands and feet, and what I would add to that, because they're so important. They're so important, actually, to build a character in a way that you wouldn't think unless you drew. And then I would also argue, like, proportion, which can be sort of asymmetrical if you're a cartoonist, right? So you can have super long features and it doesn't matter. But to get that thing right for the character that you're trying to represent is really, really difficult. I think really hard about it.
Thank you, Artiste. I appreciate that segment. We got a couple more things on the docket. The first thing is we're introducing a new game, and we needed Sig to come on the show to play this game. Lately, yes. Dave, at work, Sig has been at a running whiteboard where she's just been soliciting amazing fake indie band names. And it's been one of the highlights of coming to work for me for the last year. And so we are going to play a game, and it's called Indie Band Name Balderdash. Sig's going to read a series of indie band names to us, and we have to guess which one is the real indie band name or which ones are real and which ones are just totally made up. You feeling ready for
and
this,
I'll clarify
Dave?
That.
Yeah, I love indie. I'm ready.
Yeah.
Clarify.
And I will clarify that by saying that I will each round I will give you three names, two of which are real band names, mostly indie rock, occasionally post-punk. And there is one faker and two real band names, and I have four rounds.
Okay, we are ready. Lay it on us. Round one.
Ding, 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 ding. Powers of guess. Okay, round one, Sprout Shrew, the Afghan Whigs, and simply Cows. Which two are fake and which one is fake and which two are real.
Okay, so the Afghan
Wigs. Afghan Wigs is real.
That's real. We know that one. Isn't that like a Steve Albini project or something?
Yes, they're fairly well known. But as far as
the other two. What was the first one?
Sprout Shrew, the Afghan Wigs, and Cows.
I think Cows has to be fake. Still, that's my vote. What do you think?
I'll back you on that one, Dave. Cows is not a real indie band.
Wrong.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Cows was a post-hardcore / noise rock band from the great Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Should have known.
Formed in 1997 and disbanded in 1998 with discography. Cunning Stunts, Sexy Pea Story, the LP that came out in 1993. Yeah, so they're totally real. It's Sprout Shrew that is fake.
Sprout Shrew. That's so believable.
All
right,
so. It's fake. Okay, so round two.
I'm ready.
Round two, the band, the gripping band, Dinner is Ruined. the great, the Jesus lizard, and then the hot imperatives. Which one of those three is fake? Two are real. One is fake.
Jesus lizard, I'm pretty sure, is real.
Yes. Dinner is Ruined sounds like an emo band rather than an indie band. That's my only criticism of that name.
And the ha imperative, like
the ha imperatives plural.
Oh, the ha imperatives. Because the ha imperative. So this might be one of those trick questions where the ha imperative is actually a band, but there's no ha imperatives. You know, so we had to listen real carefully. I have no idea.
I'm voting for the Ha Imperatives because I like Dinner is Ruined. I want to listen to that whiny song, whatever they're singing.
Dinner is Ruined. Okay, so we think the Ha Imperatives is fake, Sig.
You're right.
Oh, yes.
You're both
Dave,
winners. Yeah,
you're getting good.
Dinner is Ruined is they're from the land of Canada.
Oh.
Sounds right,
Still alive since 1991, and yes, the Jesus Lizard. Also real. But yeah, no, the Hot Imperatives is fake. Okay, so...
I'm liking this. I'm ready for round three.
Well done.
I want to make up like a fake biography for all of these bands. The Hot Imperatives, that was definitely 2003 to 2007. And yeah. It was like 12 people in the band.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so round three, two are real and one is fake. London Grammar, The Digital Succulents... and Nova Social, not Nova Scotia, but Nova Social. Again, London Grammar, the Digital Succulents, and Nova Social.
I think London Succulents. Grammar is real. I think that
yes,
one,
that's real.
Yeah.
Digital Succulents is, I hope it's not real. My vote's against that one.
And what was the last one? The Nova Social?
Nova Social.
I think they're terrible, but I think they may be real. I think you're right, Dave.
You guys are really good, actually.
Yes.
You're right.
I really like your fake band names. I want all of those to be. They're like my favorite band name of the trio each time. I'm like, which is the best actual band name? It's probably the fake one.
Yeah, well, yes, London Grammar, indeed, is a British trio that was formed in 2012 to the present. Their debut EP was called Metal and Dust. I wish we had a clip. We don't have time. Yes, Nova Social is from New York and New Jersey. They're electronic pop. Okay, so
right.
We're moving on to the last round.
This is the high pressure, high stakes, Dave.
Okay, the great... Ogre, you asshole. That's the full band name. The Pillows.
Hold on. Is the great part of that, or is that your hype?
No. The great is in brackets me.
Oh, okay.
My,
so Ogre,
mine.
You asshole is the band.
Mine. Ogre, you asshole.
Okay.
Mm.
The Pillows.
Mm.
And Cookie Time.
Oh, man. I have absolutely no idea on this one.
This is the best one so far. I have no... Ogre's asshole. I love that one.
That's like Shrek inspired. It's only covers from songs that were played in Shrek or something like that. Real angry.
I'm voting for the Pillows. Although that very well could be real. I'm voting that's I'm against the Pillows.
And the third one, I'm voting for the third one you said. That's fake. What's the third one?
Cookie Time.
Cookie Time. That's not.
It could. But you're the winner here. Cookie Time is fake. Ogre, you asshole, and the Pillows are both Japanese bands. The Pillows, an alternative rock band, formed in 1989, before you both were born. No, not really. Maybe.
Pretty much.
No. I'm from the label Canyon. Anyway, Cookie Time is fake, but I think it's a great band name because I like, and I like Cookie Time.
You know, we should just cancel small talk and just suggest that all of our listeners play this game at any party they ever go to for the rest of their life.
Yeah. Well,
I could do this for years. This was very fun.
No, this is an internet black hole, a rabbit hole. It's, you can do so much. There are indie name band generators on the internet. There are whole Wikipedia pages devoted to fake band names. Like, there's just a library, as a librarian, I find it riveting.
You guys are such librarians.
We really are. Okay. Well, here's the thing. We still owe the people off the chain small talk. And the premise of this, for first-time listeners, is small talk is hard. We go to a party. It's awkward. You don't know what to say. We're here to help you. We're professionals. We've gathered at least one interesting thing for you to talk about. So people will think you're interesting, they think you're compelling, and you'll be the star of your next small talk situation. There's a lot of opportunities in the summer for small talk, and we're here to help you out. Dave, what do you have for the people?
I hesitate to even call this small talk because I can't stop thinking about this man, Yakov Smirnoff. Are you guys familiar with Yakov?
You know, I was only kind of familiar in theory until your show notes, and now I can't stop thinking about him either.
I watched that entire stand-up routine he did at work today in between patients, and like it was just hilarious.
It was so
but
good.
Yakov, he immigrated from the Soviet Union in the 80s, I think actually 79, to America, and very familiar, his catchphrase, "What the country?" And he'd get up and he'd do basically these jokes about how Russia is the worst and America's the best. And of course it was huge, amazing. And I just read this recent interview and article about him and just his whole, everything amazing. His comedy great. Maybe the most interesting thing in the article, and I think the thing you could bring up at your party, is did you know that Yakov Smirnoff and Ronald Reagan were good friends? And Yakov Smirnoff wrote jokes for Ronald Reagan to say when he went to the Soviet Union to give a speech, and Yakov, that was like the highlight of his life, and Ronald Reagan loved everything Yakov did. He thought he was the funniest guy in the world. So Yakov was actually really the force behind Ronald Reagan ending the Cold War. So amazing.
So Dave, I went to Yakov Smirnoff's website because I wanted to see if he was still performing in Branson. And he's not, apparently. He got a divorce a few years ago, and now he's doing a new routine. It's about the power of positive thinking and relationships kind of thing. But on the bottom of his website, it says, Yakov Smirnoff, favorite comedian of Nancy Reagan. That's like his tagline, which I think is both tragic and one of the most beautiful things I've read on the internet. He's like, you know what? People don't know who I am. This will get the kids interested. Listen, I am Nancy Reagan's favorite comedian. That'll get me booked for sure.
And after today, he can put my name on that. Nancy Reagan and Dave Jensen's favorite comedian. Done.
You guys aren't even old enough to have Cold War nostalgia, which I'm bitter about. Because, I mean, I love that Yakov Smirnoff because I remember the Cold War. I remember Ronald Reagan. I remember it all.
Yeah. Never had a funnier.
It's too bad.
We've never had a funnier speechwriter for a president.
Or more qualified.
Or more qualified, yeah. Yeah, it's those were the glory days, really, when the White House was filled with great minds.
Great minds.
All right, I've got a couple of things for small talk this week. They both come from the world of 18th century England.
Yeah, a prime ground for small talk. If anyone is taking notes, you bring this to a dinner party, you're in.
Mm-hmm.
So I read an article, I believe it was in The Guardian. It was called Inside the World of Mole Catchers. It was one of the most interesting things I've read in months. But basically, it's about this big debate about humane ways to kill moles in modern England. And there's a bunch of different competing professional societies and certifications for mole exterminators and assassins. But the thing that really stood out to me was this sentence. In the 18th century, mole catchers were employed by every parish in England to keep the mole population under control. Catching these creatures required such skill that practitioners were paid more generously than surgeons. Mole catchers zealously guarded their methods, divulging them only to their own children. I think that is a TV show, like an action show or something, just waiting to happen. That's the next Netflix hit series. Like some 18th century mole catching guild and their enemies. They're like mafia dons because they're super wealthy. They make more than surgeons. They only pass their secrets down to their children. You know, it's going to be so good when they finally make that.
It'll be like the Great British Baking Show but with mole catcher.
Now that is a Hollywood pitch if I've ever heard one. Let's just quit our jobs and pitch that and tell some options in it.
Move out of Madison, guys. Head to Hollywood.
Second factor.
No, I agree with you because in the same ilk as there was like the advent of reality television and then there was PBS reality television. Yes, reality television that we all love, where we watch people starve, where we watch people, you know, do you remember Colonial House? Like, it was post the Real World, but pre the Kardashians, when PBS had its reality show moment. Mm. And I feel like the Mole Catchers is absolutely prime. It's prime for PBS 2.0.
Okay, here's my follow-up idea, and it might be a crossover show, but I also read this about 18th century England. Apparently, there was a fad during which wealthy estate owners hired hermits. They thought that hermits radiated kindness and thoughtfulness, so they would put advertisements in newspapers for, quote, ornamental hermits, who were lax in grooming and willing to sleep in caves.
This was like my junior high school years.
Yeah. the job paid well, apparently, and hundreds of hermits were hired on 7-year contracts. Occasionally they would emerge at dinner parties and greet guests. So they would go live in wealthy people caves on wealthy people's estates and greet guests as the friendly hermit. So 18th century England sounds like the place to be.
It sounds like the only place where I could get a decent paying job.
If you had mole catching skills or you were lax in your grooming, you could basically be a millionaire in 18th century England.
Yeah, love it.
What if you did both? Hermit that could catch moles? Like you own England.
Yeah, then you're a triple threat who owns England. You're a double. I don't know what the third prong of that would be, but yeah.
And if you had any of your original teeth, that would be the third prong.
You guys, you really don't like small talk, because for me, when I go to a party, I also hate small talk, but I'm not at all embarrassed to just put that on the table immediately.
Oh, yeah.
And so when I am caught in a corner with somebody and can't simply just look at my phone or drink a lot alone in the corner, I just say, I hate small talk. How do you feel about your mother?
Very Freudian of you. That's good.
Goes on from there. I mean it, though. I often do that. I'm like, oh, this is, can you believe we have to talk about the weather or the decor? Like, I never even do it, but.
Sid, that's not going to make you the center of the party. But if you're talking about Yakov, you're talking about hermits, you're talking about moles, you are the center of the party.
Yeah, but I'll tell you what will make me the center of the
party. Tell us.
Which is the little news item that I came across, which is that there is a Ken doll now with a man bun.
That can't be real. That's not real.
In and of itself should be enough for small talk. However, it gets better because he is part of a motley crew of millennial, transgressive of all circumscribed boundaries tribe of Barbie dolls, now that not only include a man bun, what Jezebel reports as a calculated diversification of the Ken doll, which includes, these are Jezebel's words, not mine, black Kens with cornrows, Kens with a man bun, a male fashion blogger, Ken, in a flannel, gingham, and skinny ties. It's this panoply of millennial privileged cultural sets. I'm just waiting for, there's so many departure points here. Like, let's talk about Ken with a man bun. Ken with a man bun is not coming to rescue Barbie from the beach and the damaging rays of the sun.
No.
Ken with a man bun comes with no job, a polyamorous relationship that he is trying to justify with just endless conversation, and a shitty dog that he doesn't even take care of that well. And the Ken with a man bun comes with all sorts of problems despite the man bun.
This is crazy, Sig. I don't understand why you don't think you're any good at small talk. You'd be the center. I mean, this is the monologue I've been waiting to hear at summer parties for some time.
Yeah. Yeah, but then, I mean, like, I am all for sort of trans, I'm all for multiply marginalized identities, but I don't even think Mattel pulled it off because, like, it's still, like, privileged Ken doll with a gingham shirt who is, you know, African American and works in advertising, but there's still this whole range, like, where's the poor down on this luck Ken doll? Like, where's, like, Vietnam vet Ken doll?
Garbage pail kids, Sig. That's where they were.
Where are the Ken dolls that are truly, like, struggling, like, with real issues, like, and are real sort of alienation from society that all deserve our attention?
And my question is, looking at these pictures of these Ken dolls, is where is the Ken doll that's even remotely likable? Like, if I was having to talk to any of these guys, they all seem insufferable to me. I don't know.
One of the Ken dolls has, like, basically an Izod shirt with cactuses all over it. And Eddie Bauer knee-length jean shorts.
Wow.
And I mean, a few years ago, that was called normcore, and every sort of upwardly mobile person in Brooklyn, you know, basically appropriated suburban, lower and straight on middle class, fashion sense. But this is just like too little too late on all fronts.
So I can almost guarantee you that they have never uttered the phrase multiply marginalized in any Mattel product design meeting. So I think you're a couple steps ahead of them there, Sig. But okay. It's we can dream, you know. One day Mattel is going to wake up and realize intersectionality is real. We need to represent the many types of Kens out there. I just thought, I'm surprised they don't have a Ken Jennings Ken doll. You know, that Jeopardy champ? That is so huge in Utah, wouldn't it?
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay. I mean, also Ken. Nobody is named Ken anymore. I mean, that was like a product of the 1980s, early 80s, maybe even the 70s.
We really got to look at babynames.com to find out when the apogee of Ken occurred.
Yes.
Okay, so we've done small talk. You can talk about man-bunned Ken dolls. You can talk about Yakov Smirnov and his close relationship with the Reagans. And you can talk about how to make your millions in 18th century England. You're welcome, listeners. We got two things to close the show down for you. One was, it's summer. Summer is characterized by long nighttime road trips. You roll the windows down, you put some music on. And that's the theme for Unchained Melodies this week. Music for a long car ride at night. And Sig, I want you to take us back to the year 1989.
I mean, granted, I was, oh God, how old was I in 1989? I was 14 years old, 14, going 15 years old. But really, the year 1989 meant much more to me in the year 1997, 1989 meant more, because I was moving to Brooklyn. I was driving there. I took this quite literally, the long car ride.
Yeah.
And I knew I was moving to Brooklyn in 1997. I just so badly wanted to shed my white Wisconsin rural upbringing, and I knew I was moving to this very diverse place, and I wanted to somehow, like, earnestly embrace the polyglot. And so I remember, like, literally, like, researching at the library what it would mean to move to Brooklyn and to embrace its the cultural milieu. I didn't even know the word milieu back then.
All right, Sig, what's your song?
Okay. Magic number. It's the magic number, the great hip hop song from De La Soul. And it's a really great song if you are on a car ride, because it's perfect for, like, white people who are introducing themselves to hip hop, because De La Soul was a Long Island, a great Long Island hip hop band, but who definitely self-consciously mixed, sort of white suburban proclivities with hip hop. And it's, can you play it? Can we play a bit?
Yeah, yeah, that's what is happening right now. Here we go.
Three, that's a magic number. There it is. Difficult preaching is possible. Pleasure in preaching starts in the heart. Something that stimulates the music in a measure. Measure in the music brings it to your parts. Casually see, but don't do like the soul. Cause seeing and doing are actions for monkeys. Doing hip hop, hustle, no rock and roll. Unless your name's Brewster, cause Brewster's a party. Parents let go, cause there's magic in the air. Criticizing rap, till you're out of order. Stop looking, listen to the phrase in front of stairs. And don't get offended while Mace Dosey does your daughter. I mean, so it's from their album 3 Feet High and Rising. I don't, for me, for this, like, young, impressionable, wanting to shed the shackles of rural circumscription and Catholicism, and I was a virgin. so I just remember being like, this is what it means to move to Brooklyn. Like, this is De La Soul. I'm moving to Fort Greene, Brooklyn, and that this is going to be it. And then, of course, I was pounded down on multiple levels. But it's still a great album.
It is a great album. Great choice, Sig. All right, Dave, what do you got for Unchained Melodies? Music for a long car ride at night.
Stillman, if you're on a long car ride at night, you want to be listening to songs that are a minimum of 11 minutes long. So that is why I, of course, picked this song, the War on Drugs, Thinking of a Place. Like, it takes like a minute to get going, so you might want to skip ahead a little bit. But honestly, if you don't feel yourself transported into a Hyundai Accent driving down the road at 90 miles an hour and the sun setting behind you, then I don't know where you are.
Good. Travel through the night because there's no fear. I mean, your window's down. It is 90 miles per hour on the freeway, Dave. That's like Bruce Springsteen meets the Dire Straits a little bit. I don't know.
That is exactly what it is. Like, you couldn't describe it in a better way. But still,
you definitely have to have the windows down. Like, I mean, that's like, because how do you stay awake otherwise?
Yeah, and because anytime Dave and I are on a road trip, that car's like a death trap unless the windows are down. A lot of farting happening.
The intensity keeps you awake, Sig. Yeah, intensity.
I'm going to listen to it again.
Okay, Sig, I'm going to slow it down for us again. This is my contribution, my first choice. And this is that the principle of traveling for a long car ride at night is remain awake. And this song I'm choosing not because it helps you remain awake, but because the lyrical message is also very important. This is by Lisa Hannigan.
And no sick clothes to scream. Your eyes are a means to an end. And I would be sorry if due to your hurry you were hit by a lorry, my friend. Like you always say, safe travels don't die. Safe travels, don't die.
There's three more verses, but the message remains the same. Safe travels, don't die.
How do you, I mean, that's basically a recipe for driving and weeping.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is the song I should have been playing for Dave for Cedar on our last trip. Cedar kept asking me, Dad, am I going to die on this trip or before we get back? And I said, yeah, you're going to die, but not on this trip, I hope.
I hope. You might not die on this trip, Cedar, ideally.
50-50. I don't want to lie to my son, Dave. He answers, I'm going to tell him the truth to the best of my power.
Cedar, you might die. Santa Claus isn't real.
That's pretty much
You're lucky Cedar is as resilient a child. Because I would have started screaming and weeping. What do you mean, Dad?
Safe travels. Don't die. All right, Sig, choice number two. What's the number two song you got to play at a long car ride at night?
Oh, my God. Okay, so this, I don't know what you guys are about, because for me on a long car ride, I'm not a night person, so I have to stay awake.
We're depressives.
And for me, Phil Collins, against all odds, parentheses, Take a Look at Me Now, from the movie Against All Odds, 1983. Outside of Han Solo, my first crush ever was when I was too young, my feet pajamas, little girl, older teenage sisters watching HBO, free week of HBO downstairs. And I went downstairs and I was like looking through the railing and I see the most beautiful male vision, which is Jeff Bridges in the movie Against All Odds. With Phil Collins in the background playing Take a Look at Me Now. And I was crushed. I mean, like, that was the permanent imprint of the most attractive, I'm such a cisgendered straight girl, like the most attractive male specimen ever. And so Phil Collins with Jeff Bridges in Against All Odds and that song, like, take me, like, they carried me through my life to this day. Like, I don't think anyone will ever
hear
it.
They don't.
It's so passionate.
How could
I just let you walk away?
Oh, yeah.
Just let you leave without a trace. How could you? I don't know how to say. Taking every breath with you. You're the only one really knowing me at all. At 6 years old, by the way. God, it's still so good. It's still so good.
I was really hoping your crush was on Phil Collins, because that would have been shocking and amazing.
No! Oh, my God.
It's way better that it was Jeff Bridges. But I will say, that was one of the hardest songs I've ever had to fade down. I mean, I wasn't expecting.
There's so much energy.
It's soaring.
And on a long car ride, like when you have to stay awake, one thing I have done when I've been falling asleep on long car rides is it's not coffee, it's not cocaine, it's not anything else, but I start to sing and that will keep me awake.
Singing loud, hitting the steering wheel, that gives you an extra couple hours on your drive time. Phil Collins is the magic maker.
This is a broken football player. Oh my God.
All right, I got another song that's a little bit more upbeat. This song for me is like another classic summer at night driving song. This is the great blues legend R.L. Burnside, and they did a little remix on a record called A Bothered Mind. It's called Someday Baby.
Y'all out there? All right, let's get this thing moving. Yeah.
I need a song at some point where my leg is kind of thumping. You know, you put on a cruise control and you got to wake yourself up, get the blood flowing again, and that's that song for me.
That's great.
Thanks.
I love that.
So, guys, you both fundamentally misunderstand what it means to drive at night.
to be alone with your sorrow. That's what it means.
You need a song that is speaking to your sorrow and is transporting your heart to a place of deep emotion without increasing your pulse whatsoever. So last song for me is Song for Zula by Phosphorescent.
That's your type,
it's
Dave.
Really pretty.
That is your type.
So lovely. I mean, it really is beautiful. I do sort of get it. But, like, to me, I guess I can't drive late at night and just break down crying the whole time.
That's the only kind of night driving Dave does.
Because both of you picked me songs that were just so stunning to listen to. Like,
sick. Some people drive to arrive and others drive to forget, you know?
I drive to just, like, you know, fantasize and live.
Not us.
No.
But no, that's why I want to listen to all of those things when I actually have a quiet moment, which this podcast wouldn't indicate I ever have.
Sick, you've been the best guest. All right, what we need to do, we need to end this podcast with book wisdom. What that means is we're going to share a moment from a book that's had an impact on one of our lives. And Sig, as the guest of honor, would you do us the honor of favoring us with some book wisdom?
I would. I feel like this takes it down a notch in a sense, but I love the late, great David Rakoff. He had this perfect way of sort of putting intention, both like a profound sense of humor, and then also a great seriousness and weight and heaviness about life. And he used those two things together in ways that I just so admire and that resonate deeply with me when I read, and I wish that I could pull off, which I never will. But that move me in so many ways. And so his book that he wrote in iambic pentameter, right? So is it, it's called...
I just have heard of this. I've never read it.
Yes. It was published posthumously after he died, but he wrote this book called Love, Dishonor, Marry, Die, Cherish, Perish, a novel. And it's a series of fictional profiles of people that I won't go through all of it, but me. And it struck me that he could, as a gay man, he could write about the experience of women, and particularly cis hetero women, beautifully and from a class perspective. And so one of the profiles he has in here is about a woman named Helen, and the lead up to the part that I'm going to read is talking about a woman from a down on her luck background that is working in sort of pink collar corporate America, and has an affair with a powerful boss, and then is ultimately becomes pregnant and has an abortion. And the title, the title of the piece talks about how she ruins a Christmas party. And so the part I'm reading is after she's had this affair and it's just beautifully set up. And then she's at this Christmas party. She's just terminated a pregnancy and her boss will no longer even acknowledge that she exists, but she's grateful she still has a job. This is after she realizes she still has a job and she's leading up to this Christmas party. And so he writes, "There were stories of girls all summarily sacked who found out they no longer had jobs to come back to. At least she had that. But she started to feel that it hardly seemed worth it to work for a heel. For each passing day found her feeling less grateful, primarily because he was hurtful and hateful. Some minimal kindness was not a tall order. Instead, he was rude or he outright ignored her. Until she decided that this wasn't right and stood in the door of his office one night, she asked if he'd ever again say hello. Fedora'd and coated and ready to go, he took a step backward, as if sensing danger, and fixed her with eyes of a cold-blooded stranger. 'I know what your game is, and frankly don't care, but don't threaten me, Helen. I warn you, beware.' The very next Monday, from others she heard that without her knowledge, he'd had her transferred, at least, tiny comfort, they didn't demote her, but Helen became what is known as a floater, doing steno for this one or helping with filing, and through it all, Helen made sure to keep smiling. The salt in the wound was the sight that then faced her, those looks he exchanged with the girl who'd replaced her. Mm. She made herself steely, was ever the stoic. She held back her tears with an effort, heroic. But something was growing with each passing day till it burst forth the night of her shameful display." This is the Christmas party. "She figured they'd fire her within the new year, but Helen soon realized she'd nothing to fear. What she didn't know was the company's bosses viewed Helen as one of those typical crosses, a company's role it is sadly to bear, a lazy one here or a crazy one there. And no one made any move to relieve her, but mostly because they just didn't believe her. Perhaps there are those who consider it shameful that Helen comes yearly, all dressed up and gameful, just showing herself in the very same setting cannot be a help to ensure folks forgetting. But she won't stay home or remain out of sight. To do so, she thinks, would just prove that they're right. She might have been drunk and too forward, uncouth, but each word she'd spoken had been but the truth. Miss one or two parties, and then, before long, the general consensus would be she was wrong. A version to which she refused to be pliant, so each year she stands there, alone and defiant, while others quaff cocktails and gradually lose the strictures that slowly dissolve with the booze. There's tippling and coupling, embracing with brio, and all being scored by the hired jazz trio. Helen just stands there, observing it all, sipping her gimlet against the far wall." I won't go on. It goes on much, much longer, but it's so beautiful. Like how he could do this with this, you know, this kind of childish rhyming and capture class and gender and the experience of women and the experience of being disempowered so stunningly. It's so beautiful. And every single profile in this book is so stunning and it's so heartbreaking.
It's too much. It's so sad. I can't think of it not in the context of who's our president right now. And I can't think of it not in the context of, you know, my daughters are going to be grown up eventually. And one day, yeah, they may not be treated as they should just because they're women. And I can't handle it.
Yeah, it's sad.
Thank you. The luminous David Rakoff. I think that's the first time we've had rhymed poetry on the show, and I know Dave appreciates. He always tells me that unrhymed poetry isn't real poetry. So finally we had real poetry on the show. we're going to have to cut the episode.
This is the 75th episode, Steele.
Yeah, this is the 75th. It's a memorial episode. This is our golden anniversary or whatever. I don't know what.
Is it really the 75th episode?
You're a milestone, Sig. We had to pull out all the stops. Thanks, Sig, so much for being our guest. Had a great time. You're terrific.
This was great fun.
It was wonderful talking to you.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you.
Off the chain. It's off the chain.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Let me, I need to open my tabs.
It's time to get the tabs going. Dang.
And two steals.
And two steals. Okay, we're good. We're good.
Yeah, that's good enough.
That's
yeah.
The perfect number of steals.
Steel always demands that we put an extra picture of him anytime we do a hangout.
Ah, that's just so weird though. It's only, that's only with weird Scandinavians.
Okay, so I'm working on it.